You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the Dreaming. Now, if you tuned in 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was playing some interviews from some members of the Black Sovereign Movement who were interviewed at the recent BSM conference that happened down in the King's Domain about a month ago now. I've still got a few more interviews to play, so I'm going to play some of them next. This first one is from Uncle Eric Fijo, who's from Darwin. I actually noticed the other day too. Quite a disturbing event. Uncle Eric was actually arrested up in Darwin the other day for protesting some of the new repressive laws that have come out there from their local state government. You know, he was peacefully protesting. He wasn't doing anything illegal or anything wrong or destructive or, you know, even obstructive. And he was still arrested. So, you know, quite a despicable state of affairs, that one. But yeah, this is an interview from Uncle Eric Fijo.
Okay, we're here at Camp Sovereignty. We've come to the end of the Black Sovereignty Movement conference. I'm here with one of the delegates, Eric. Would you like to introduce yourself and talk a bit about what it is that you do?
Yeah, no worries. Hello, I'm Eric Fijo. I'm from Darwin. I'm Larry here. And I've come down here to support Sovereignty, Black Sovereign Movement, in this country, and continuing on from my old people that were down here in the 70s and way before that, in particular the 10 Embassy in Canberra.
Right. Can you tell us why you decided to attend the conference and what you were, I guess, hoping to get out of it, before you came?
Yeah, so like I said, I'm up and down. We might as well be on the moon where all the masses are down south. And in my observations, they don't seem to take any notice of what's going on with First Nations in particular in the northern part of this country. This elected members federal governments, both a higher house and lower house, and supposed to be elected representing the electorate, the people of this country. And it's disgraceful that I've had to watch and look every day as they turn the constitution based on a lie, and our representatives, especially First Nations, most of them, and they're kowtowing to this bastard constitution and the lie of the foundations of this country. I've been fighting all my life from kid for my identity and my country, and I will keep fighting, and I'll share that with my children and my family and my community. This Senator Thorpe, I know, because I've been called and slandered for every name you can ever imagine being called. So I just say, chuck them on the end of the line. And all the names that they say, they're calling themselves that. Every time they say a statement, they're talking about themselves. So I've been really inspired and grateful that I've been invited down by like-minded and to meet like-minded people, old fighters and new. And importantly, the new and young ones that need direction from old hands that been around the bush. So these last couple of days, it's just been a real revelation to me that to be sitting down with like-minded people and strategizing what I'm calling, this is our survival. You know, anyone can call it what they want. And, you know, I hope, you know, all your non-Indigenous listeners, you know, have a think about what's really being said in this country. And, you know, it's not always about football and soccer and sporting events. You know, have a look at what's really going on in this country and why people are paying so much taxes and multinationals are getting a free ride off the back of our blood, sweat and tears. And, you know, the lucky country, how our elected representatives and politicians and prime ministers, how they've thrown us under the bus. Disgraceful. How John Howard, he had the audacity to do the intervention on a lie about and calling me and my people in the Northern Territory pedophiles and woman bashers. And I found out the other week that a while ago he went and covered for ex-prime ministers and high-ranking judges in the court systems for the pedophilia, and he's covered for them. And he's put a 85, 90-year silence on that. So how can the double standards that they do and they keep crucifying us because they're living the lie that they live at our expense? And you look at the statistics for incarceration, suicide. There's no Aboriginal language that I know of, and I know a few different languages, but there's no language that specifically says suicide. It's not in our language. So and now, you know, among the incarcerations, which is a national disgrace, and the lack of empathy and the lack of concern from our elected members, who are kowtowing to the lobby groups, the Zionist lobby groups, and the other multinational lobby groups that are benefiting of the lucky country, so-called lucky country. So I really encourage your listeners, and, you know, call me whatever you want. I don't care. Just don't call me late for dinner. But just call me whatever you want. But have a think about what you're saying and have a look at what's really going on in this country and how our elected members, our representatives, elected members supposed to be representing us. Well, who are they really representing? So call me what you want, call Senator Thorpe what you want, but I'm a proud black man and First Nations people of the Larrakia tribe and Warrawungu tribe. And Darwin's my home, the territory's my backyard, and it always was and always will be. So thank you very much, Bub, and I encourage all your listeners, have a really good look and see what's really going on in this country and see if you like paying the taxes that you're paying and living the life that you're living in the lucky country. So have a lovely life.
I've got one more question.
1 minute.
You said you've been, you know, doing this fight your whole life. What changes have you seen over that time, and where do you hope the fight goes?
What's your name, man?
Manju.
Manju, thank you for your last question, so I'll answer it. All my life, when we had the Northern Territory being unique because we had the 1976 land rights, the states didn't get it, but that's another story. And all the players know about it. I certainly do, how it and unfolded and how come the states never got it. But us in the Northern Territory, we got the 1976 Land Rights Act, and the 1976 Land Rights Act created in the 1988 Sacred Sites Act, which is unique in the Northern Territory. We never had the Native Title Act, but Mr. Mabo proved the lie of terra nullis and the lie this country was built on. So we should never have it. We had the Land Rights Act. And all my life, and my elders, mum and dad, and all their siblings, all their brothers and sisters, and all my uncles and aunties, after the 76 Land Rights Act, and all the hard yards that the Larrakia did as well, in where the bomb dropped in the capital city of the Northern Territory. So our dreams and aspirations of my elders were all swamped and drowned by the lies of their consecutive governments and the continued lies, and how they're still doing it now. And now you've got the ideology of the Chief Minister in the Northern Territory, who broke all her election promises in the first month and has shut down all First Nations service providers, everything that we've got, and incarcerating and locking them up in more numbers. A national disgrace, and the prisons and correction service, whatever you want to call them, you know, they're not even Australia owned. They're privately owned gravy trains, and the name of the gravy train is the black gravy train, and the name of the gravy train is misery. And the people like the Chief Minister and the likes are all the black bloody conductors of the black gravy train. So that's what I've seen, and I've witnessed firsthand, and all the deaths. We've just had so many deaths in the last 5 months, but so many deaths, and we're still having them. And there has been no joyfulness and happiness on what all the broken promises were built on, you know, with the Land Rights Act and all the marches in the street and all the stuff that hard-fought victories that were just pulled away from this one signature that's all it took from one Chief Minister and ideology, you know, and because we are the minority of the minorities in our own country. So Australia was built on my country. I'll just remind you, all your listeners, of that as well. You know, people, please have a good look and call me whatever you want, but have a good look and think about things before you go jumping to the guns and saying, oh, Eric Vijo, he's this and he's that. Well, at least I put my name and money where my mouth is. So have a wonderful day and have the days that you deserve.
Thank you.
That last interview was with Uncle Eric Vijo. And again, just want to give a shout out to Manju for all of the great work with actually recording those interviews at the BSM and, uploading them all for me and sorting all that out. Absolute legend. Really appreciate it. Up next, this next interview is from Jade Kennedy, who's actually from my country up on the south coast of so-called New South Wales.
I'm here with my second interview. Ani Sue was first. We're here at Camp Sovereignty for the Black Sovereign Movement Conference. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, my name's Jade Kennedy. I'm the eldest son of Dutch and Kath Kennedy. And I come from the Illawarra and South Coast, New South Wales.
Beautiful. I have been up there, was it 2 years ago? And it's such a beautiful country out there.
That's where it all began, man.
Yeah. So can you talk a bit about, I guess, what kind of stuff you do and why you came down to the conference?
Yeah, sure. In 2000, a fully intact skeletal remain uncovered itself at Sandon Point, which is in the Wollongong region of the Illawarra. And that particular place where that body was found was sold by the local council to a developer. And at that point, our family went in and put up tents because those skeletal remains were our ancestors. They were our direct family. And I was about 20 years old at the time, and that started my sort of interaction with this sort of resistance, really. Dad led the charge. My old man's Roy Dutch Kennedy, and he's currently serving time based on this resistance and this fight that we had. But we created an embassy. It was called the Sandon Point Aboriginal Tent Embassy, and many people that are here today, Coco, Uncle Michael Anderson, Mick Mansell, like I said, Uncle Robbie and his brother Uncle Mick, these are people that came along at the time and supported us in our activism to protect country and protect our artefacts, but also just to protect our places and spaces that are significant to us. And we started to experience the racism that is embedded within legislation. We also just started to experience the racism that's embedded within our communities and society generally, around the ways in which Aboriginal cultural heritage, Aboriginal values are regarded, and the ways in which we started to experience that was quite confronting, you know. So our embassy was burnt down 3 times. We had a lot of support from local people, but at the same time, what you're looking at is an overarching disdain for Aboriginal people, number one, but just the ways in which we value things today. So we say a lot within the education system, we say a lot publicly within organisations, but when it really comes down to us protecting what is sacred and significant to us, it causes destabilisation within our communities, and we're pretty much told to shut the fuck up and go away. Mm. And we didn't. And, you know, this is the aftermath of a 16-year campaign. Like I said, one of the results of that was my father's currently serving a 10-year sentence in prison because we exposed the corruption within legislation. You know, they had overnight bills passed to change the National Parks and Wildlife Act, you know, the Planning and Development Act in New South Wales to justify their theft of not only our land but our cultural sites and sell them to a degree. So that, for me, started my journey on this type of activism and this ways in which we start to challenge what it is that creates, you know, the standardised understanding of culture, but also just the standardised understanding of who we are as a people and what our place is within this current madness, I'm going to call it, you know. Like, we've got a situation where we're talking about some pretty big things here today, and I think that it's extremely encouraging that you've got a situation where people have come from across the country. You've got some real old players here, and you've got, you know, this sort of new breed coming through as well that are trying to find ways to respond to, you know, this ongoing structurally, legislatively, you know, legally endorsed eradication of our people, our cultural heritage, our stories, the significance of those stories. And for me, it's difficult because we currently live in a day and age where corporatized, I don't know, agendas are really starting to infiltrate our communities. We're losing a battle to, in some cases, our own people, apart from the fact that you've got these structural, legal, sort of, I don't know, underpinning ways of doing things in this country that not only disable us, but disadvantage us at every turn. So I think it's really meaningful that people are coming together, Aboriginal people are coming together and trying to find solutions for the ways in which we're having to racially engage with a society that's trying to delete our existence. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious what ended up happening with Sandon Point. It's still there.
Sandon Point, Aboriginal Tent Embassy,
yeah,
to a degree, is still there. This is one of the things for me that having that experience and looking at places like Camp Sovereignty and looking at other places across the nation, you think about Coco at Musgrave Park and, you know, other Aboriginal people that have continued the fight. You know, there was a systemic dismantling of our presence. It's been assimilated into the local narrative, and the staunch advocacy that we had is impacted when you have the trauma of family being jailed, when you have government agendas that are generally around development. And for development to occur, you need to destroy cultural heritage a lot of the time. So Sandon Point, we were able to achieve what they call as an Aboriginal Place Declaration. Again, that's a decree that exists within state-based legislation, right? So you're still limited to a degree around what it is you can and can't do and the ways in which you can and can't protect that site. So the Aboriginal Place Declaration is an effect of the National Parks and Wildlife Act. Within that act, you cannot have a dog off-leash. You can't have a dog off-leash in a national park. So we've got an Aboriginal Place Declaration at Sandon Point. Sandon Point is on a headland and it has a beach that's a part of it. That beach is currently the only dog off-leash zone that is untimed in the LGA of the Wollongong City Council's lands, right? If I go to council, I stand on the council floor in front of 20 council members and representatives and state the fact that they're in breach of their own legislation, and the next day the mayor and 200 residents and their dogs stand on that beach for a front page photograph to say we're not going anywhere. That's the current state. So if we comply and if we abide by whatever legislation is, and if we wear our Aborigine shirts and if we display things on NAIDOC Day or Sorry Day or when we're told to express ourselves and our cultural values, then things are okay. And that's the reality that we're experiencing, is that whenever we choose to bring to the attention the fact that the Australian government and all the way down to council, all the way down to our communities, are not respecting our values that we've apparently been given through your own processes, the minute that we do that, we're subject to some sort of punishment, some sort of way of being put back in our box. And for me, that just undermines the whole entire situation that we've got today. We're told that we're reconciling, we're told that we're, you know, a multicultural country, we're told that we respect the values of others, but when it comes to us saying, hey, we're not actually abiding by what we say, we're shut the fuck up. And that seems to be the reality of our experience within that place and space. So Sandon Point is acknowledged technically as an Aboriginal place that allows it a certain level of protection, but the reality for us is that we don't get to experience that, because the minute that we step outside of those bounds, you know, I mentioned earlier this morning, I was jailed for 21 days without charges. Mm. You know, these are the type of things that will occur if we step out of line. And that situation for me was that I was asked to say there was Aboriginal cultural heritage where there wasn't, because the University of Wollongong was being taken to court by Lendlease, a developer, for $200 million. And the role that I was supposed to play was to slow that process down so that the university could take Lendlease to court for not meeting one of their milestones. When I refused to do that, I end up in jail. This is the reality of what our people are experiencing when we start to have conversations at that level. And these things for me are not only the bringing together of an amazing set of experiences and amazing minds around the ways in which we continue to combat this oppression, but it's also the opportunity to build networks around the ways in which different communities, different individuals, different country groups have been able to address this type of structural and institutional racism. It's inherent within the Australian Constitution. It's a direct attack on us as a people. The denial of our sovereignty, the denial of our rights to our country. It's all good and fine if we just speak about it academically. But when we actually sit on the ground and we have to negotiate legislation, or we have to negotiate simple activities, signage, you know, activities that we want to hold within our communities, the minute that that sits out line of some sort of precedence being set by that community, we find ourselves vulnerable and in the potential wake of imprisonment. It's dangerous, you know, and I think it's very brave of everybody that's here today to stand up and say, this is who I am and this is what I believe and this is what my experiences are, and how can we use those experiences to find ways forward to continue to combat this injustice?
Yeah. So I guess from the, we've just come to the end of the first set of discussions.
Yeah.
How's it gone so far? What are you personally hoping comes out of this conference?
Yeah, look, I've been pushing my little 10-point plan. I just keep pushing that in the background as a way of mobilising and setting a framework around the ways in which we can try and move forward. It's really difficult, you know. There's a lot of hurt within our communities. There's a lot of traumatic experiences that individuals have had. There's a lot of war-tired, you know, warriors out there, you know, that have been at this for a long time. So these things take time. And part of the difficulty is that we sit within a space of feeling like we don't have time. There's so many things that are needing some sort of advocacy. There's so many things that need a bit of attention and a bit of help along the way, you know. And so we're stuck within this situation where we're trying really hard to be focused on outcomes and outputs, but to some degree I think just being together is healing for people to share their stories, and I'm starting to experience that myself, and I can see others doing that. So I think that's just one massive already positive outcome that's come from just coming together today. I believe with the people that we have here that we'll find a way of activating at least some movement towards addressing some of the collective issues that we have. Some of them are big and fairly insurmountable, but just the fact that people are standing with their feet and having the conversations, that's already a chipping away at these institutions, at these legislations, you know, at these constitutions.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, like you were saying before, it's so nice to see. I mean, it's an intergenerational thing for a lot of people. You just said you know.
Sure.
It was your dad, and we've got people. Yeah, we've got elders here in their 70s, their 80s, and we've got some newborn babies.
Yeah,
so.
Right. It's wicked, man.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful to see, and it's something for me that's so encouraging, being privileged, I guess, with the opportunity that we had at Standard Point. Like I said, there's people here that were there, and that's, you know, 20 years on. And to continue to see these people turn up, not for themselves and not even just for their communities, like for all of us. You know, that's massive and it needs to be respected, but it gets positioned as radical or activist, or it gets positioned in a negative connotation because it's moving away from ultimately what's assimilation. And I think we need this to start to relight that fire and start to generate that warmth, that breath within us that says, hey, you know, like, we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility for generations and generations after us to be able to set a platform for people to be able to advocate for the equality of everything, you know. Trees are our family. Birds are our family. I hear possums are a problem down here. Like, possums are our family, you know. And how do we start to incorporate them into the decisions that we're making, you know?
Oh, yeah, I think everyone's got family members that are a bit...
Yeah, we do. We find different ways of dealing with that, don't we?
Yeah. Oh, great. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
Nah, thanks for the interview. It's been lovely to meet you.
Thank you so much.
Darling. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, see ya.
Good on you, babe.
That was Jade Kennedy, one of my relatives, actually, from... up on the south coast of so-called New South Wales. His mob's done a lot up there around stuff. A whole bunch of stuff, really. But as he was mentioning in that interview, you know, it's a lot of stuff around Sandon Point, which is, I suppose, for lack of a better term, you know, in many ways it's our own version of Camp Sovereignty up on the south coast. It's the spot where we've gone and taken some land back and set up a sacred fire and stuff, and it's a spot that we can use for, you know, cultural stuff and for healing, for talking politics and doing all that great stuff. Now, we've got one more interview. This one, shamelessly, is with myself. But yeah, I'm going to play this last one.
All right. We're here at Camp Sovereignty. The Black Sovereign Movement Conference has just happened and is wrapping up now. I'm here with one of the, I guess, organisers and delegates to the conference, Kieran. Kieran, do you want to introduce yourself and talk a bit about what you do?
Walawani, Nayaga Kieran, Nayaga Din Waniwandin. Yeah, my name is Kieran. I'm a member of the Black Sovereign Movement and the BPU, and I helped Senator Thorpe put the conference together and, you know, bring mob from across the continent all here together so we could have a good yarn and try and strategize for where we're going over the next couple of years and how we empower our sovereignty and actually practice self-determination.
And this meeting, it was a closed meeting, so it was mob only. Why was that an important element of it, and how did you feel about the conversations that happened?
Yeah, it's a really important element to try and have it as mob only, because when we have, you know, other people, allies come in, some of them might have the best intentions, but, you know, they come into the space and they quite often have this paternalistic attitude where they know what we need to do and, you know, or they think they do. They think they know what we need to do and, you know, they think that they have the solutions for our issues. But at the end of the day, you know, we know what we're up against. We know how to fight back, and we've been doing it for over 230 years now. So we really need these Aboriginal-only spaces so that we can just be together. We can talk freely as well and not have to worry about, you know, offending other people or, you know, what other people might hear. And we can just have the discussions and yarns we need to have so that we can all get on the same page together as mob, and we can all be fighting the one battle together.
And there was quite a few people that attended, probably about 40 people or something. And there's some pretty big hitters here, I guess, that have been in the struggle for a long, long, long time, some big names. How was that for you, I guess, as someone that's a bit younger coming up?
It was really good to have, you know, a lot of these elders and a lot of these hard hitters here that have been at this stuff for decades, you know, just to be around them and just to take in their wisdom and experience and, you know, learn from them what has worked, what hasn't worked, you know, look at what we can be doing as the next generation as well, how we can support our elders, and how we can continue this fight without falling into the same traps that they've fallen into, or, you know, without coming up against the same obstacles that they've been fighting against. You know, it's just that intergenerational wisdom. It's so important in this fight.
Is there anything in particular? There was a lot of different topics that were covered or on the agenda, and is there anything in particular or any specific direction that you would like to see the movement go, yeah, I guess within your lifetime?
So one of the big things that come out of the conference is the need for us to go back to our own mobs and our own nations and to do stuff like set up, you know, the equivalent of the camp sovereignties on our own nations, get those sacred fires burning and, you know, have all of those interconnected spots right across the continent where we're exercising our sovereignty, where our people have our own space to practice culture and to practice healing and, you know, to be that base of our political struggle. So that was something that was really good that come out of it. Another thing that was really good that come out of it was the whole idea around continuing to share knowledge between our elders and our next generation and, you know, working with our elders and setting up stuff like elders' councils so that the younger generation can have that guidance from that and that wisdom from the elders. And in doing so, you know, we'll be so much more empowered and so much more smarter in what we're doing.
Yeah, totally. No point in repeating the mistakes and stuff. I think when I was talking to Uncle Robert, that was something that came up a lot because he was saying, like, we were talking about the same things back in the 80s. And, yeah, he just talked about a lot of distractions that got thrown in the way that masked as being solutions. And he was like, don't take the bait, you know, like really wanting the younger mob to know that. Yeah. And how was it organizing in this type of space for you? You said that you're also part of the BPU. Is there much difference between the two groups?
Look, we are two separate groups at the end of the day, but there's a lot of crossover with membership and also a lot of crossover with what we're actually fighting for. You know, at the end of the day, we're both fighting the same fight, which is the fight against our occupation by the British colonisers and, you know, the fight for our sovereignty, our culture and our self-determination. So it was really good to have, you know, both those orgs and Crime Scene Australia represented here and, you know, as a part of the organising it all. And it was also just really inspiring how quickly it all come together. You know, this was all only organised maybe 2 weeks ago. We started organising and started, you know, ringing people up and booking them in for flights and hotels and whatever else. And so, you know, it's really good to see what can come together with only 2 weeks' notice. You know, in the future, try and plan it a bit more in advance and hopefully we can get even more people here and can have, you know, even better conversations as a result of having more mob here and, you know, that wider perspective and that wider knowledge and wisdom. But, yeah, in saying that as well, if you're listening, you know, this stuff isn't for free. You know, we, as much as we would love free airfares and free hotels, you know, those things aren't free. They do cost a lot of money. So if you do have a few dollars, you know, you can donate to the Black Sovereign Movement or you can donate to Crime Scene Australia or the Black People's Union, any of those organisations to help us fund this fight and, you know, help us get together more often as well, because what we can achieve when we're together is so much better than, you know, a 1 or 2 hour Zoom meeting that we might have. You know, actually being able to be there together in person and to build up that relationship with each other as well and to have the conversations we don't have to worry about, you know, who's listening and stuff like that, it's so much more powerful. So, you know, there's a big need for us to be able to access funding to continue to do this stuff in the future.
Yeah, totally. Definitely donate. There's so much, I don't know, there's just so much money out there that's just going to charities and, I don't know, places where it's all wasted on admin fees and stupid uses like that. But this, yeah, donating to these types of really grassroots organisations is such a better way to spend your money or run a fundraiser. Anyone can run a fundraiser. It's not It's not difficult to do. And, yeah, it's benefiting you too. And you might not even know it. Yeah. Is there anything that the Black People's Union is working on at the moment that you want to promote and plug?
There's a few things, I suppose, of public interest. So we're looking at kicking it off our public education classes again soon. So this is something we've done for the first year or so when we first set up. And we had a lot of interest in it and a lot of people that came along to our free online education sessions, and we're looking to kick them off again in the next month or so. You know, stay tuned, go look at the BPU socials or subscribe to the BPU's newsletter on our website, blackpeoplesunion.org, to stay up to date with that and to, you know, be in the loop of when those are happening. But yeah, really excited to kick off the public education stuff again and to be able to, you know, just educate people about the history of this colony as well as what's happening now and, you know, how we can combat all of that stuff. The only other thing I would probably want to plug is, at the end of last year, we started a BPU Solidarity Fund, which is a fund that we use to support mob right across the continent with stuff like sorry business,
and as well as, you know, stuff like getting into housing, because, you know, quite often our mob, you know, we're 10 times more likely to be homeless than anyone else. And quite often when we do get those rare opportunities to be able to actually get into housing, our mob don't have stuff like the money to pay for bond, or, you know, don't have money for furniture or whatever else. So we try and support them with that as well for the Solidarity Fund. And yeah, as I was saying, sorry business, you know, a lot of our mob don't have the money to bury their loved ones. And it's, you know, absolutely despicable fact. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is a fact. So we use our Solidarity Fund to support mob with burying their loved ones as well, as well as just, you know, continuing to survive however they can. Like, we do stuff like we run BPU Kitchen down here in Naam in Dandenong. We're also, actually very exciting, we're spreading that, and there'll be a new kitchen kicking off soon up on the Sunshine Coast, a BPU community kitchen up there. And the Solidarity Fund helps to fund stuff like that as well, you know, just to go out and feed people, not just Aboriginal people too. The BPU kitchen is there for anyone who is, you know, homeless or struggling and could use a free feed.
Great. Thanks so much for chatting, Kieran, and keep up all the good work. Your inspiration, bro.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jajara on Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
Alrighty, that's just about it for today's show. We got about 10 minutes left in the show. So I'm going to go to a song or two to see it out, and I'll be back again. I'll be back again on Sunday on Earth Matters, and then back again on Yilliman at the same time next week.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.